Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome into Living Off the Land, episode 280. I'm Dan, here with Champ, and here with my co-host, Steven. Steven, how are we doing? It's Tuesday night.
Tuesday night on an absolutely beautiful night in the CLE. Oh my gosh, today was fantastic. Sunny with a high of about 75. A little bit of light breeze out of the north, so it was a little cooler along the lake.
Shout out Reliant K.
Right, I was just going to bring that up. Absolutely fantastic today. That's just the way the weather goes. You know, some days you roll snake eyes, and some days you roll boxcars this time of the year. And today we got boxcars. So, or as they say at Jack Casino, crap 12. So, but anyway, we got a double feature coming up first with you for BCAN, and then also a return of a former segment we used to call the catch-up. So we got that coming up tonight. We've got the NBA playoffs starting this upcoming week and a whole bunch of other related stuff. The Guardians, of course, continuing play and doing so rather strongly, I might add. So, and then, of course, there might be some other news. So we'll get started with BCAN. So tonight, again, the last couple weeks we've been out on the east side. Today we head back to the west side of Cleveland. And we head to a neighborhood that a little over 10 years ago was not desirable territory. It was, in fact, the epicenter of the growing heroin epidemic in Cuyahoga County. And even 5 to 7 years ago, this was an area that was being referred to by many as Cleveland's bohemian community, and I felt like that was being nice. But this neighborhood perhaps has been probably more emblematic of the positive change and transformation within Cleveland within the past decade more than any other neighborhood in the city. Today, it is extremely desirable. It's a place that people are literally beating down doors to get into, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. I am talking about Detroit Shoreway neighborhood. This neighborhood is, geographically speaking, is bounded in the south by Clark Avenue, on the west by West 83rd and West 85th Street, on the north by Lake Erie and Edgewater Park, and in the east, sort of jagged, but between West 41st and West 44th Street. So, this neighborhood just about has everything. It has great parks. It has, obviously, the main park in the city, Edgewater Park, is part of the neighborhood. Edgewater, since being taken over by the Cleveland Metro Parks in 2016, prior to that, it was not all that nice of an area, honestly. And, you know, people would always comment about there being stuff in the water and not being all that clean and all that. But now you've got all just the beach has been completely redone. I mean, they literally comb the beach on a daily basis with the equipment. And, you know, you've got two areas. You got the upper part of the park where you've got playgrounds and some other stuff, and then you've got the Script Cleveland sign is over there, and then of course on the lower section that's where you have the park itself, and then you've got all of the green space and all the trails, and then at the far end you've got the pier, of course. Actually, that's more toward the middle, not at the end. At the other end, that's where you have the Edgewater Yacht Club, where you've got there's a pool over there, and of course that's where a whole bunch of people keep their boats. There's a public boat ramp just off of the right from main Edgewater Park as well. And just within that complex, I'm not sure what's in the building, if it's a restaurant there or if it's just like kind of beach hut. It could be both, actually. I've never actually been
Where?
Inside the building at Edgewater Beach.
There's a bar upstairs, like an outdoor bar. There's no like restaurant or anything.
Okay. I've never actually been inside the building. It seems like whenever I go there, it's not open, but maybe I just need to go there.
I don't think you can actually like really go in it. I mean, I think there's bathrooms maybe, but you can go upstairs where the bar area is, and there's like it's like a covered patio up there. But
yeah, literally, as you come down the ramp from West 73rd Street, that's about where that is. That's one of the main links from the neighborhood itself into Edgewater Park. And right there, that link at West 73rd Street, that's where Terrestrial Brewing Company is. That's where In Good Company and the All Saints Public House is. Battery Park Lofts, and a few other major high-rise buildings have been put up there. And these are some just interesting-looking buildings. There's some very extremely modern, postmodern architecture in that, you know, little terrace that kind of overlooks Edgewater Park. It's really quite astounding when you look at, when you're considering what this neighborhood used to be and what it is now. If you talk about the residential neighborhoods, the as a whole, the average home price according to Zillow is $230,000. That is over the city average. It's a little bit over the state average of about $211,000. It's up about 8% year over year from this time last year. And interestingly enough, Realtor.com says that the average median home price of a house that's being listed currently is about $349,000, which is way above the average home price, which tells me that a lot of houses are and high-rises are being newly constructed, and they are selling like hotcakes. So you have a sort of dichotomy of you have some of the, you know, the older population perhaps is just kind of staying put, but you have all this new construction too, perhaps with the younger folks, young working professionals that are inhabiting this neighborhood. And so, you know, it's really great. So you have kind of like both sides of it demographically. And if you just kind of look at it from a commercial standpoint, you've got two main commercial corridors. One is along Lorraine Avenue, but the bigger one is along Detroit Avenue. It's interesting because if you look at Ohio City, the commercial corridor along Lorraine is a little more dominant than the one on Detroit. It's opposite in this neighborhood. The one on Detroit is a little more dominant. And as you come in, as you go eastbound from westbound from West 52nd Street, it just kind of starts, and it's just amazing some of the stuff you see here. Astoria Cafe and Market is the first one you come to at the corner of West 55th in Detroit. Then you come to Happy Dog, which is the next block down. Then as you get closer into Gordon Square, there's just a number of places that you go to. There's two places that are very popular in the mornings, Gypsy Beans Coffee Shop and then Brewnuts, which is actually donuts and beer. So that place is going literally all day. If you've ever been there, that's certainly a place to check out. You've got Blue Habanero, which is right there, also in Gordon Square. Just a block down to the west is one of my favorite places to eat in the whole city, and that's Ninja City Kitchen and Bar. These guys actually come into the Metro Health Kitchen at the main campus every Monday, and I almost always get their food. It's just fantastic. That's Asian cuisine. That's Japanese, Korean, a little bit of Chinese as well. And as you just continue down, there's a whole bunch of other local establishments. Ready Set Coffee Roasters is at the corner of West 74th and Lorraine. Detroit. That's another local coffee shop. So again, you kind of see this is considered to be a little bit more of a night neighborhood, but it is also a morning neighborhood when you consider some of the businesses that are there. And of course, with Edgewater Beach there, if the weather is nice, I mean, you can pretty much just go down there anytime. I can't say enough about this particular area. It's just, I mean, if we go down to Lorraine, to the commercial corridor along Lorraine, Sense Pizza and Goods is down on the corner of West 54th and Lorraine. You've got the Judith, which is another coffee shop, which is at West 55th and Lorraine. Forest City Shuffleboard Arena and Bar, that is at West 46th and Lorraine, just across the border from Ohio City. That's a place I've actually been to. That is a really fun time. I love shuffleboard. Shuffleboard is basically curling on concrete. I find that to be a very fun activity.
Yeah, shuffleboard's fun.
So that's definitely a place to check out if you've never been there. And then ultimately, and we're going to talk a little more in depth about this place, my opinion, not only the best pizza shop in Cleveland, but the only pizza I have ever eaten, not just in Cleveland, but anywhere, that tastes actually like authentic pizza that you can get in Italy. And that is Il Rione Pizzeria, which is where we were this past Friday night. It was your birthday this past weekend. We were there for your birthday Eve celebration, mm-hmm. I guess you'd call it. Il Rione is at the corner of Herman Avenue and West 65th Street. I also have to give a shout out to Stone Mad Pub, which is right across the street from there. That's a pub with a little bit of emphasis on Irish fare. And you talk about a business being in a perfect spot. I mean, Il Rione is small. It's kind of hard to get into, particularly on the weekends. So, like, there's often a long wait. People just go across the street to Stone Mad, and they just hang out until the table's ready.
Stone Mad loves Il Rione.
Absolutely, positively. So Il Rione has this absolutely delectable, thin but yet not super crunchy crust. That's just... It's incredible. It's just, it's like I said, it's very, very authentic, much more so than any you'll find almost anywhere. But the thing that blew me away this time was, so we're here with Jordan was there, former co-host, shout out Jordan. Ryan Donathan was there as well, along with Jen, his wife. Shout out Jen and Ryan. And my wife, Ren, and my daughter, Scarlett, came along as well, along with one of your good friends, Mike, as well. And so Ren and I, we order two pizzas. We order the traditional red sauce margarita pizza with sausage and pepperoni, pretty much like what you would get at, I mean, you get that at Pizza Hut or any pizza shop, to be honest. And that was excellent. But what really blew me away.
You're walking a dangerous line. Don't ever compare Pizza Hut to Il Rione.
That wasn't what I was going for.
I know. I just want to give you crap.
Yeah. But anyhow, we have this thing where, like, I consider Pizza Hut to be, like, far and away the best of the national chains, and Dan doesn't really agree, but, you know, but whatever. But anyway, like, even that simple a pizza, you can't compare this with anywhere else, certainly not with a chain. It's just fantastic. In fact, the margarita red sauce there, it had a little bit of a spicy kick to it. In fact, which I didn't really expect. Even a Ren, who, like, she eats really spicy food and, like, you're, like, crazy spicy. And, like, even she remarked, like, oh, this has a little bit of a kick to it. So, you know, if you get her to make a comment like that, then, you know, it's at least it'll sting your tongue a little bit. But what really blew me away, we get this white pizza. We get it with prosciutto and arugula, which is basically lettuce or kale, in my opinion, or spinach. I wasn't expecting too much out of this pizza. I'm like, okay, this is the change of pace pizza, you know, whatever. We'll get the white pizza. So I take a bite out of this because actually they had the red pizza came out like a few minutes after the white pizza. So I take the white pizza first. Holy moly. That was like pizza nirvana.
Yeah,
biting into that. How do I even describe it? It was like the cheese, the crust, the olive oil, and whatever other seasonings they put into that thing was like, oh my goodness gracious, that was incredible. I didn't even barely taste the prosciutto. It was just like, it just was there to have a little bit of heaviness to it because it was so light otherwise. Oh, I mean, it was absolutely delectable. I was frankly blown away. I couldn't believe how good that pizza was.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the best pizzas I've legitimately ever had that last Friday. I just couldn't even believe it. So, like, I guess my recommendation would be, if you ever go to Il Rione, get the white pizza because it is absolutely out of this friggin' world. Dan, do you have any opinion on this? Like,
what?
Like, the pizzas that you ate last Friday night? Or like,
I mean, if you've listened to this podcast, I basically I'm just repeating myself. It's the best pizza by far in the city. It's the best pizza. I would love to know if there was a pizza better in the Midwest, the entire Midwest.
Boy, oh boy! I mean,
and I'm calling out Chicago, deep dish. No, Il Rione. You said you compared it to Italy. I compare it more to New York, New Jersey.
That's fair.
I mean, that's one of the owners of the shop is from New Jersey. I always get the slice pie, which is not on the menu. If you go there and you just want something simple, order the slice pie. It's essentially a New York style cheese pizza. I've always maintained with an authentic pizza shop that has really good ingredients, simplicity is key. So for me, all I need is dough, sauce, cheese. If the pizza shop is good and is worth its salt, literally and figuratively, all you need is dough, sauce, cheese on a pizza. You know, if you're at home with buddies watching a game and you get pizza from a chain, yeah, throw all the toppings on there you want, because you really don't want to taste the dough, the sauce, or the cheese on that because it's processed nonsense. So yeah, get your meat lovers, get your veggie, your supreme, your all that stuff. You don't need to do that at Il Rione. You guys are, I mean, you guys didn't throw a lot on there. Like you said, pepperoni sausage and then
two toppings each.
Yeah, so you were good there, and pretty much all of us. I think everybody else basically just had like pepperoni. I know Jen got, she got the speck pie, I believe. It was another white pizza, but it's just divine. I need to know is if Michael and Mary Beth have been to Il Rione.
I think they've been once.
Okay, all right. I feel like that's a place that they would really enjoy.
Oh, they absolutely would, especially my dad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Your dad being from the East Coast.
Yeah.
I'm sure your dad grew up having New Jersey style pizza.
Yeah. I mean, it's. Yeah, you can get like New York style pizza, I mean, Philly's South pretty, Jersey and Philly. I mean, it's maybe not 100% authentic, but it's not far away.
Philly's got some. Philly has some really good pizza shops too. So
yeah,
you know, I mean, you can pretty much go anywhere and find good pizza. There's good pizza in Detroit.
I mean, Detroit style pizza, I go for like
Detroit,
I mean,
style pizza is great. Yeah. It's fantastic.
I prefer it to Chicago, to be honest.
Yeah,
I'm not a big deep dish guy.
Well, it depends. So Chicago technically has two styles of pizza. They have deep dish, and then they have really thin, cut in squares, tavern style pizza.
Oh, interesting.
That you see more, I think, on the south side, more so. But yeah. So anyway, yeah, Il Rione is just, it's divine. It's the best. It is the absolute best. We had a great time. Utmost recommendation of Il Rione for me.
1303 West 65th Street, just a block or two north of Gordon Square. That's where you'll find Il Rione, and that's where you'll find Stone Mad Pub as well. I can't say enough about this place. If you go there, do note that they do not take reservations. So nope. If you want to get in on the weekend.
Says it in big bold lettering on their website.
Either get there early or go later, because you will be waiting quite a while if you get there between like 6 and 8:30.
Yeah, we waited about an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, which actually wasn't bad. Friday night, the weather was horrible. So I feel like some of the folks that may have been considering going out probably stayed home. So that probably helped us.
And it's also not as bad. Like if you're going for, like, it's a great date spot. So if you're going and it's just the two of you, you're not going to wait that long. We had, like, it's not a big place. And we had, what, seven plus a little kid. So, yeah. They basically, you know, they had to put two tables together for us, and eventually, actually, a third. So I do know that they do not take groups over 8. So we were almost at the limit. So, once you might be like, really? That seems kind of weird. Once you walk in there, you understand. It's not a big place.
It's really only two dining rooms. I mean, the maximum small. That's probably could fit, what, maybe 100 people in there, tops?
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Anyway, that is Il Rione, and that is Detroit Shoreway, the complete and total renaissance neighborhood of Cleveland, in my opinion.
Yep.
And you can wham that with both hands.
Yep, 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 yep. Very good, very good. You dropped a couple of interesting tidbits in the introduction. What are we getting caught up on tonight?
Well, we are getting caught up on the week that was with the Cavs and the Guardians, but with more emphasis on what's coming next for the Cavs, although I do have some interesting thoughts about how the last day of the regular season played out.
Oh, don't get me started. The Cavs and I are in a complicated relationship right now because...
It's getting a little more complicated for me, too.
We might as well just talk about the Cavs. I have no faith in this team. None. Absolutely none. And the way that they went out in the last game of the season, and apparently they did it on purpose. really pisses me off.
So to set the scene here, Cavs had the chance to move up as far as second in the Eastern Conference standings if they would have won and if they would have gotten help from elsewhere, namely the Knicks and the Bucks losing. The Bucks had a game at Orlando. They were actually almost never in that game. And when it came to the end of the third quarter, the Cavs were winning by about 10 against the Hornets. And the Knicks were narrowly losing their game. I forget who they were playing against, but it was a situation where the Bucks were surely going to lose. The Knicks might but could possibly still pull their game out. So worst-case scenario, a Cavs win would have moved them up to third and a date against Indiana in the first round. If the Knicks would have lost, that would have moved them up to second, and that would have meant a date against either Philadelphia or Miami. A loss would have dropped the Cavs, well, kept the Cavs in fourth. They would have played Orlando. So J.B. Bickerstaff sees this lay of the land and made a decision to literally pull the entire starting group from the team, except from the game, except for Max Strus, who he kept in for a few minutes into the fourth so that he could pick up a couple rebounds or something to get a triple-double.
Yeah.
And then he yanked him with like 9 minutes left in the game. So the calculation was thus that we didn't want the 2 seed, clearly. Third, I don't think would have mattered all that much.
For what reason, I don't know.
But evidently...
Oh, third to me matters.
We very... This was a move that, for me, just reeks of cowardice. But more so than that, it doesn't suggest confidence at all. The fact that they literally ran... They put the end of the bench in. Charlotte comes back and wins the game. And
which, by the way... Excuse me. Mid-yawn. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Charlotte sat about 8 of their players for that game.
Yeah, they had G Leaguers basically playing in this game.
Yes. And yeah. According to J.B. Bickerstaff after the game, he said that this was their plan all along for the game, was to play everybody 3 quarters and then sit them for the fourth. I don't understand what that does. What is 12 more minutes going to do? If you're worried about guys getting injured, just don't play them.
Why do you even play them at all?
Right. And they said it was an organizational decision. So obviously that means that Kobe Altman was consulted in this. Mike Gansey was the GM and J.B. Bickerstaff. But it's just like, so to me, what this says is the Cavs liked their first-round matchup against Orlando better, and that is literally all they're concerned about, is just getting out of the first round.
Yeah.
To me.
That's obviously what their aspiration is, and it's nothing beyond that because...
I get it. Philadelphia and Miami in the second round, not a great matchup. But guess what? You're going to have to play Boston in the second round now.
Right.
Like, far and away the best team in the East. Like, I get it. They've had their struggles in the playoffs in the past, but...
Forget the East. Best team in the league.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Like, why would you even want to put yourself on the same side of the bracket as them? It just goes to show you that... They're only concerned with round one. They could care less about any aspiration beyond that.
Agreed.
And I'll give a shout out to the New York Knicks because they were in a similar situation here. They had a win and they get the 2 seed. They could have laid down.
Yeah.
And they could have not come through and, you know, they could have dropped. But instead, they fought like hell to pull their game out. They even went to OT and they pulled their game out and they got the 2 seed because they're trying. They have bigger aspirations than just round one. Evidently, the Cavs don't, is what we found out on Sunday.
That's what it seems to me. I mean, obviously, they're not going to say that, but I just don't. They were trying to set up the best matchup for the first round, in their opinion. But, I mean...
What would really piss me off, and I mentioned this on the podcast last week, when, like... You were just straight negative, and I was trying to find the silver lining in things. And I basically said, like, you know, you win two or three, you win the last 3 games of the season, you go into the playoffs on a 3-game winning streak. Okay, you're not playing great teams, but still, that's going to make you feel a lot better about yourself. That's going to give you some confidence going in. And they would have done that. They literally had that more or less sealed up at the end of 3 quarters. And then they did what they did. If I'm one of the players, like, I'm not with that. Like, that would annoy the heck out of me if I was Darius Garland or Donovan Mitchell or Evan Mobley. Like,
Which those guys
it's a vote of no confidence,
those
really.
Guys didn't play in the game anyway, but, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's a complicated relationship between me and the Cavs. Listen, I'm going to root like heck for them to win against Orlando, and then, you know, I'm going to root like heck for them if they do beat Orlando and go up against Boston and meet their almost certain demise in the second round. But, yeah, I mean, I'm going to root like hell for them. Am I confident in them? Absolutely not.
How can you be at this point?
No.
I've come over to your side, Dan. Like, last week, I was, like, still trying to be the positive one, but, like, what they showed me on Sunday was they're not confident, and they are trying to gain this.
And, by the way, it was Fan Appreciation Day, and that's what they did?
Yeah.
You had an opportunity to win that game against a team, like you said, full of G-leaguers, which would have given you the 2 or the 3 seed had you won, so it would have improved your seed. Like you said, you would have won 3 games going into the playoffs and gotten some sort of, you know, momentum. And you would have sent the fans home happy when you were one of the few teams in the NBA, which I read this morning, I think one of 6 teams in the NBA to sell out every single game this year.
That's a huge accomplishment.
Cleveland, Ohio, in a year that LeBron James is not on the team, they sold out every game.
Every game.
And that's what you did? Should be ashamed of themselves. And listen, when Saturday comes and game one against the Magic comes and that place is rocking and rolling like it always is in the playoffs, am I going to be negative like this? Well, sure, if they come out and lose like they did in game one last year.
Right.
But if they could, but during that whole game, I'm going to be rooting like heck for them. But in the back of my mind, I don't know.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the game itself, because if you look ahead to this series, I think it's very rare that game one is like a be-all, end-all game.
Massive.
But like game one in this series is absolutely humongous.
Absolutely massive.
The Cavs got drilled last year badly.
At home.
They come back into the playoffs this year with the.
They never got up, by the way, and they got knocked down in game one, and yeah, they won game two, but they never got back up. Sorry.
They come out, and now you're in a series this year where literally, if you don't win this series, you may have wholesale regime change.
Oh, not maybe.
Organization.
Not maybe.
Like Bickerstaff surely gone. Kobe Altman might possibly be gone too.
Yeah.
You know,
again,
there's a lot on the line here.
And not only that, you could be looking at significant roster changes. They could trade Donovan Mitchell when he inevitably turns down a contract extension.
Oh, I think that's going to happen regardless of what happens. I didn't even want to talk about that, but
I think if the Cavs go to the Eastern Conference, if they somehow find their way to the Eastern Conference Finals, I don't see Donovan Mitchell walking away. I don't see where he's going to go. The New York Knicks possibility is not out there anymore, but
yeah.
I don't really see where he's going to go, but I could see him maybe signing like a shorter term, like 3-year extension with the Cavs, and then we're doing this whole song and dance again in 2 years. But
we're going to learn in this series just how mentally tough the Cavaliers are.
Oh boy.
Do they have it between the ears or not?
Oh boy.
And it'll really be severe gut check time if they end up losing game one.
For a multitude of reasons. Also, if you look at the other side of this series, you have an Orlando Magic squad who essentially nobody on that team has ever played in the NBA playoffs, number one.
Yeah.
And if they walk in here and steal game one, you want to talk about a team that's going to play like they have absolutely nothing to lose and the pressure of the entire universe is going to be on us? I mean, that building in game two is just going to be an anxious mess.
Yeah. It's going to be one of those situations where you talk about home field advantage not being good. Like, the minute, like, we make a bad play or something, you hear the groans in the crowd and, you know, people, it just becomes an overly negative atmosphere. You know, think Brown Stadium back when we were terrible. We used to, like, boo after every time there was an incomplete pass or
what the eventual outcome was going to be after 60 minutes.
Right.
But almost an 80% chance the Browns were going to lose.
Yeah.
Even if they had a lead, you knew they were going to do something to screw it up.
Yeah. So that's not what we need here.
No.
Ideally, Orlando gets a little bit googly-eyed in game one. They don't play well. Cavs win that game. And then they start questioning themselves a little bit, like, do we really belong here? You know, like you said, if Orlando comes out and they win game one, it'd be like, oh, this is the playoffs? Oh, this is no big deal. Yeah. You know, we're good.
And then they'll just play loose the rest of the series, and we'll probably lose in five or six again.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, it's gut check time, and the Cavs need to use last year's learning experience. The only way that I'm going to start feeling confident about this team again is if we come out and we just beat them by 30 in game one. Because then I'll be confident that they actually learned from what happened last year.
There's one other reason I'm really annoyed that the Cavs did not win on Sunday and at least lock up the three seed, which is what they would have gotten.
Why is that?
So they would have played Indiana in round one, which, I mean, still would be a tough series. I think it would be marginally more difficult than Orlando. Maybe I'm underrating Orlando just a little bit. But in either case, you win that series, guess who you're likely playing in round two?
Milwaukee.
No, it'd be New York. If you were the third seed.
Oh, yeah.
New York is number two.
That's right. Milwaukee would have fell.
So you would actually have a chance to knock out the team that knocked you out last year if you hadn't run like scalded dogs against the Hornets.
In the second round, too. So it wouldn't have been a first round.
Right,
so,
right.
So,
which
yeah.
The
like,
stakes would have been even higher.
Yeah.
Like, right. That's what the, like, was that part of their calculation, too? I mean,
well,
we weren't thinking that they were thinking about round two, but I'm thinking that, like, were they really thinking, like, they'd rather play Boston? Like,
if
that
is,
doesn't make sense.
If that is, they've already lost, and they're probably going to lose to Orlando. Because I'll tell you this, Orlando, if you look at their team, and I'm not really here to get into the minutiae of the matchups and the basketball, Orlando poses a lot of the same threats that New York did last year. They're really good defensively, they're really physical, and they're really big. So is Jared Allen going to go from 6'11" to 5'11" like he did last year in the playoffs?
Talk about some, like,
you know, that stuff's going to happen.
Out of all the players that need very badly to play well in this series, he's top of the list.
Yeah, all of them do. Who played well in the series last year? Nobody.
Yeah, not really.
Not a single player. Donovan Mitchell, for as great as he is, he was awful in that series last year.
Yeah.
Darius Garland wasn't great, and he's had a crappy second half of the season. Evan Mobley, I mean, still kind of looks like a baby deer out there, you know? So, yeah, I would say Jared Allen, because he got a brunt of the criticism last year, probably is under the most pressure to perform this year, but they all are. They all need to play well. Because, quite frankly, if they don't all play well, I don't know that they can beat, or I have no confidence that they can even beat Orlando. And what confidence should I have? They have no track record of being successful. Other than when LeBron has been here.
Yeah, not at this stage. Mm-mm.
So, it's been a pessimistic 15 minutes, but we're going to be rooting like heck for them on Saturday. They have not announced what time. I would imagine the Cavs are going to be one of the early games on Saturday. Probably like
could be the opening game.
Yeah, could be. What would that be? Like a
12:30
noon, like a
or
nooner?
1 o'clock?
Yeah, could be. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. But, yeah, I mean, hopefully they beat Orlando in five or six games and we're done talking about this stuff, because you literally wash all of that away if you just come out and wax Orlando.
The NBA play-in, if you look, expand it out to the whole league now, the NBA play-in tournament is going on the next few days. Out west, the Lakers, Pelicans, Warriors, and Kings are going for the last two spots in the West. The Heat, the 76ers, the Hawks, and the Bulls are going for the last two spots in the East. I would highly expect that Miami and Philly will advance in those two spots. Although, I don't know, Atlanta, they were the team that kicked us out 2 years ago. So, like, I don't know, maybe they've got the potential on a one game and out scenario to, you know, knock out Miami or Philly. You know, Trae Young just randomly goes for 50 or something like that. But what is locked in right now is Milwaukee is playing against Indiana in the first round. Cavaliers obviously playing against Orlando. Out west, You've for sure got the Timberwolves playing against the Suns and the Clippers playing against the Mavericks. The Thunder and the Nuggets are the top two seeds out west, and they are awaiting the play-in winners. So there were some conspiracy theorists that were saying tonight that the Lakers were going to throw away their game against the Pelicans because they didn't want to play against Denver. Obviously, that's not the case. They're winning that game by 13 right now. I always thought that was kind of hogwash. So that, you know, especially out west, these playoff series could potentially be all just super, like, usually 1 versus 8 and 2 versus 7 series aren't that interesting on their face. But think about out west. You could potentially have Steph Curry and the Warriors as an 8 seed going up against the Thunder, who are the top seed in the conference.
Right.
And then in the other, in 2 versus 7, you'd have the defending champions, the Nuggets, going against LeBron and the Lakers.
Yeah.
Like, wow. That's amazing. And even like 3 versus 6, Timberwolves versus Suns is like, I mean, Kevin Durant and company going up against, you know, Karl Anthony Towns and those guys. Like, you know, there are some, I got to tell you, this might be a rare NBA playoff tournament where, other than whoever the Celtics are going to steamroll in round one, it could be really interesting right from the jump. Like, the Bucks, we don't know about Giannis Antetokounmpo's status. He might not even play for much of the first round.
Right.
That could give Indiana a better shot. You know, the Knicks, if they got to play Philly or Miami, like, does anybody really want to play Miami in round one? I don't think so.
Probably not.
Given their track record in the playoffs. So, like, this is going to be legit, like, an actual fascinating tournament, like, right from the first round. And you don't get that very often.
No.
So, it all gets going on Saturday. Again, Cavs, I think will probably be the first game of the day. We might be the second game, but I'm thinking they're going to put us up in first. So, but anyway, that's what's going on there. And if you go just down the street to Progressive Field, the Guardians started their week with a series against the Yankees, who, of course, came in with the best record in baseball at 10-2. And, you know, the Guardians put up a fight in the first couple games. In the first game anyway, they lost 3-2. In the first game of Saturday's doubleheader, they didn't play Friday, obviously, because of all the rain. And then really took it on the chin in game two of that series, losing 8-2. But just when it looked like they were going to get swept aside, losing 7-5 in the 10th inning, they pulled off a massive comeback late in that game, winning that game 8-7 in the bottom of the 10th to at least salvage one game from that series, which I think is that's a real confidence booster, just to know that you actually, you know, got out there, we're in a really bad situation and was able to pull that game out and beat one of the best teams in the league. You still lost. That's actually the first series loss the Guardians have had all year. But, you know, losing 2 or 3 of the Yankees, there's really no shame in that. Like, the Yankees are, what are they, 12-3, 13-3, something like that? Like,
yeah, they're very good.
You know, so, you know, no harm, no foul there. And then, even better, the Guardians get on a plane, they go to Boston, which is like, that's one of the last places you want to have to go right after playing the Yankees.
Yeah.
And not only that, but they go to play at Fenway on Patriots Day.
They play at 11 o'clock in the morning.
You know, early start, literally just as the Boston Marathon is ending.
Taking out the chowds.
And they go out there, and pitchers collectively throw a three-hitter, and they win the game 6-0.
Yep.
Like, it doesn't get much better than that. Like, just, Boston was never even in that game. Like, the Guardians just, well, I can't say that because it was 0-0 in the fifth inning. So it was a while before the Guardians started scoring runs. But once they did, you know, they just had the game on lockdown from there. And that's kind of the way it is with the Guardians. You know, once you get the good starting pitching, you know, the Guardians bullpen, you know, I don't know if you consider them elite, but they've been pretty darn good up to this point.
Yeah, well, speak of the devil, the first guy that came in relief after Tanner Bibee gave up 3 runs in a third of an inning and got yanked. So Guardians were up 5-1. It's now 5-4 in the bottom of the 6th. Boston still has guys on base, 2 outs in the bottom of the 6th.
This could be the critical moment in this game if the Guardians are able to get out of this inning without further damage.
Yep.
They might be able to pull this game, too, but if it turns into a big inning for the Red Sox,
Yeah, boy.
Not so good. But this game's still very much in play. The Guardians right now 11-5 on the season. That's very strong. That is currently second best in the American League behind the aforementioned Yankees. And currently leading the division only by a half game. The Royals are 8-2 in their last 10 and have put in a bit of a surge here. So at 11-6, I don't know how legitimate that's going to be in the long term, but that's who's currently right behind the Guardians. The Tigers right now 10-7, the Twins 6-9, and the White Sox, boy, are they bad, 2-14. Oof.
Yeah, they're horrible. I think their batting average right now is like 186 as a team.
That's unbelievable. That's like,
as a team, they're below the Mendoza line.
Worse than one out of every five.
Yeah.
Gee whiz. So that means they're basically only getting like, what, 4 hits a game? 5? No. 6 tops? Like, that's really bad.
Yeah, it's not so good. So, yeah, I mean, the Guardians are, they are keeping up with this hot start, man. If they're able to pull this game out tonight, and obviously if you're listening to this, you'll already know that, they will move to 12-5 on the season, which I believe is tops in the AL Central. I know the Royals were...
It is. They're up by a half game over the Royals.
The Royals. So,
there's a few things more satisfying than going for a series sweep at Fenway.
Oh, hell yeah.
That doesn't happen too often. I mean, when you get to do that, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting. That'll be fun. Obviously, go figure. The one game, the Guardians, so far that's gotten rained out is the one I wanted to go to on my birthday.
Yeah, figures.
So technically it wasn't my birthday, but whatever. I need to get to a game soon. Shout out to anybody who's jonesing to go to a Gardo's game down at the corner of Carnegie and Ontario. Whether or not the Guardians are in contention all year, it's always a fun summer down at the ball yard. That's the one thing about baseball. You know, say what you want about the state of the game. It's not great right now, but maybe it's just because the childhood memories we've had at that place and just the overall feel when you walk into that place. The Guardians could be 20 games out of first place, and I will never turn down an opportunity to go to Progressive Field for a Guardians game, because you're just going to have fun no matter what. So I can't wait to go to hopefully 10 or more games down at the ball yard this summer.
10 or more is the goal, folks.
That is the goal. I wish I had already had one in the chamber, but alas.
So I was putting the bet down on FanDuel, and the over-under is 10. Should I pound the over or the under on this? I wonder.
I don't know. That's
hopefully it's the over.
Yeah.
Because life's too short to bet the under.
That's exactly right. You got to bang the over. So we shall see. But
bang it.
Yep. All right. The Masters was on Sunday.
That's right.
And the number one player in the world showed exactly why he is exactly that on Sunday. Scott Scheffler takes his second green jacket in 3 years, and he ends up kind of running away with it, to be honest with you. I mean, once they hit the back nine and Homa hit the ball into the bushes off the tee on 12, and, when DeChambeau chipped one into the water, I can't remember what hole that was. He was done. I actually think that was Saturday.
Yeah, that was late on Saturday. That was on 15.
Oberg was the one that he hit the ball in the water on 11 on his approach shot. He hit the bank, and it bounced right into the water right next to the green.
Two guys in a row did that. Oberg did that, and Morikawa did that. Yeah. And it was on the very next hole that Homa, you know,
hit one into the bushes.
Yeah, it's so funny because,
when you
barely miss hit a ball, it's like,
oh, so especially that hole with that green.
When these guys hit into par threes, I'm used to them like the ball stopping on a dime and then either spinning it back or, you know, what have you. But like this looked like one of my shots on par threes. It landed right in the center of the green, just bounced really hard, and just went right back into the bushes behind the green. It's just like, yep, that's pretty much what I would do if I play in that hole.
Yeah. So. And I wonder if those guys started to feel the pressure, because Scotty really started turning it on at the end of the front nine and then over into 10. He birdied 8, 9, and 10, and that essentially allowed him to take control of the tournament, because, like we just talked about, 11 and 12 essentially eliminated everybody else in the field.
Yeah,
that had a chance of winning, that being Homa, Morikawa, and Auberg. But then, you know, Scotty just, I mean, he just essentially cruised after that. There was really not much pressure on him.
The shot that Scheffler hit on 9 came within inches of going in for an eagle.
9?
Shot
and
of the
then,
tournament.
What was it? Was it 15?
Yeah, 15 later.
He came within inches?
Again.
On an approach? Yeah. I just, when his irons are firing, this might be hyperbole. When his irons are firing, he's about as good as Tiger in his prime.
And this round literally felt like Tiger in his prime.
Yeah.
He was up there.
Listen, I'm
he
not
was
talking
playing
about.
Well, and the others just crumbled.
Yeah.
Like that. That's what happened all the time with Tiger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like it's the intimidation factor. And it's a different kind of intimidation, because Scheffler's kind of like the aw shucks, you know, like, you know, not happy-go-lucky, but like the aw shucks, like buddy-buddy type guy, where it's like you're not going to get intimidated by, like, say you're playing with him and you're standing next to him. Like, when you're standing next to Tiger, most of those guys just crap their pants. He was that intimidating in his prime, just like look because of how intense he was.
Yeah.
Scotty is just kind of like he's like a kill you with kindness kind of guy, but. I mean, you'd never know it by watching him actually swing the club, because the guy is just absolutely nails. So yeah, and I was the idiot that just bet everybody else but Scotty.
Mm.
Yeah, lost about 50 credits on the Masters weekend.
My pick, Xander Schauffele. He ended up finishing in 8th. I think he was like 1 or 2 under.
Yeah, he started off slow on Thursday, but Friday and Saturday he kind of got it going a little bit, and then Sunday he was just he just couldn't make up Thursday.
No, yeah, that's par for the course for him. He's usually in the hunt, but he never wins.
Yeah,
so
well, I mean,
go figure.
Yeah, he's one of those young guys. The same with Max Homa. It just seems like a couple of these guys are just they are on the precipice of breaking through. Like, obviously, that was Max Homa's best performance in a major to that point. But the guy's in his mid-20s. I mean, of course, like, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about Scottie Scheffler being the best player in the world. He's only won the Masters. He hasn't won any other major yet. He's now a two-time Masters champion. But he's 27. He's also in his mid to upper 20s.
The way he played in this tournament, I'd be outright.
Oh, he's going to win another one this year.
He didn't win at least one of the other majors.
Yeah, he's going to win another one this year.
He was so far head and shoulders above everybody, especially in crunch time.
Yeah,
it'd be hard for me to believe. Like between the PGA, the U.S. Open, and the British Open, like he's got to win at least one of those.
Yeah, he's the best ball striker on tour, and if he gets the putter going, I mean, just forget it.
If he wins the PGA, you're going to have some people starting to
slam.
You know, the Scotty slam.
Yeah.
You know, Tiger's the only player who's ever won all four majors
the same year.
The same, you know, rotation.
Same rotation,
basically.
Not the same year, same rotation.
You know, because you won 3 in 2000, and you followed that up with a Masters win in 2021.
Yeah.
But, or excuse me, 2001, my bad.
Do you think the LIV guys, the playing only 54 holes consistently in tournaments is starting to bite them in the ass when they get to the fourth round of these majors now. I know Brooks finished second at the Masters last year, but he was bad. John Rahm was horrible this week, and he's just now this year on the LIV Tour, so it's an adjustment for him. I wonder if these guys that only play 54 holes in tournaments are now, not that they're not conditioned, but like playing 18 holes 4 straight days under that pressure is crazy.
And at least they made the cut, unlike Wyndham Clark.
Yeah, that guy
didn't even do that.
Boy, hand up on that one. That was a complete swing and a miss by me. Holy crap. to open your mouth like that and then not even make the cut.
Just do plus six the next day.
I mean, that's something that might ruin his whole year. I mean, he might not recover at all from that.
Talk about a hit to the ego.
I mean, still a great player, but yeah, to call your shot like that after Thursday and be like, oh, well, 54 holes left.
I think the bigger factor than playing just 54 holes instead of 72 is the fact that their schedule doesn't have as many events on it as PGA Tour does.
Yeah.
They it's very rare that they play in back-to-back weeks.
Yeah,
sometimes they have weeks, you know, two weeks in between tournaments, and it's like, yeah, you can just like kind of just hang out at the resort, yeah, you know, for the week and
they're
do whatever.
They're playing in shorts. You know, everybody's all the patrons, the fans, they're having a party. They're blasting music at the tee box, you know. All this crap, and then you go to the Masters where it's literally like military. Like, you know, you can't the crowd, they can't bring their phones in. You can't run at the Masters. Literally, they cannot run. Like if you're on like if you want to be oh I want to go see Brooks Koepka, but he's like four holes behind Scotty, you want to see him on eight and Scotty's on 12. You see Brooks. Hey, bogeyed another one. All right, let's go to Scotty. You can't, like, if you want to run, can't do it. They'll kick you out.
So I cannot bring my running shoes to Augusta National.
Cannot. You can power walk.
Oh, dang.
That's as much you can do. You can power walk.
All right.
That's the crazy stuff about Augusta. It's just, I love that tournament so much. It's my favorite. It's always been my favorite. Initially, probably because it always, almost always landed on my birthday weekend. It was either that or the weekend before.
Yeah. I do think the culture of the LIV Tour does not exactly breed competitiveness. I don't think it precludes these guys from winning. But if you look at the trajectory of some of these guys, like I'll use Bryson DeChambeau as an example. He was one of the top guys on the PGA Tour when he left for LIV.
Yeah.
I don't get the feeling he's the same player now.
No, he's a head case now.
You know?
Has a LIV golfer yet won a major?
Brooks Koepka is the only one that I can think of.
Yeah, he won a major while on the LIV Tour.
I think so. Didn't he win the PGA last year?
Yeah, I think you're right. And Rahm, obviously, is, but he didn't. He was
that was before he left.
He was on the PGA last year when he won the Masters.
Yeah. Yeah, I worry about him now, too, because he was one of the top guys, and now I don't know if he's going to be after a while.
There was some rumor that came out today that was making it the rounds on social media saying that LIV was preparing to offer Rory McIlroy a godfather offer of like $800 million to leave the PGA and go to LIV. And whatever tournament they're playing in this week, somebody in the media got Rory as he was walking off the range and like asked him that. And he's like, I have no idea where they come up with this stuff. I have not been approached by LIV. I'm not going to LIV. Like, it's just... And at this point, there's so many talks about like LIV and PGA merging to like end this menagerie. Why would he do it now? I mean, I guess if they're actually offering that kind of cake, like yeah, you take it if you know that they're just going to merge in a year or two and like this can all be over. But Rory has been the staunchest opponent of LIV Golf, even more so than Jon Rahm, who had a lot of choice words to say before he eventually gave in and joined. I just don't think Rory would ever do it.
Flopper.
No, I just don't. Yeah, I just don't think Rory would ever do it. Mm. But anyway, he didn't have a good week this week. Neither did Brooks Koepka. Bryson DeChambeau imploded after was leading after round one. We already talked about Wyndham Clark, who was my pick to win the thing. Yep, put that on the board for me.
Derp.
Yeah. So congrats to Scotty on another Masters win. And like you said, I mean, he's absolutely going to be the betting favorite at the PGA of Valhalla. That's in June, right?
May.
May. A couple weeks. Wow.
It's gonna be May.
It's so weird because like the PGA, it used to be the last major.
In August.
Yeah. So it's like they're going like April, May. Are they going April, May, June, July?
April, May, June, July.
Wow.
Yeah, because like August is like the FedEx Cup like, I don't know, last few events for that, and then they actually have the FedEx Cup tournament in September. So
yeah, and then the NFL and college football gets firing up, and I don't think they want to deal with going up against college football on Saturday than the NFL on Sunday.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because I always wondered why the PGA Tour schedule is always so front-loaded and, like, they don't play big tournaments in September and October, because I love fall golf.
I absolutely love it.
It's fantastic. But it's probably because of that, what you just said. They don't want to compete with Major League Baseball. They don't want to compete with the NFL. You know, intuitively, it makes sense. They'll get better ratings before the NFL season.
Yeah,
starts.
I don't think they care about baseball. It's college football in the NFL. Because let's be honest. Are you watching? And this is if you're a fan of both. If you're a fan of baseball and you're a fan of golf, are you watching a baseball game in August, or are you watching on Sunday? Are you watching a baseball game in August on a Sunday, or are you watching the final round of a major?
If it's a major, definitely a major.
Final round of a major.
I don't know if I'm watching the RBC Canadian Open
or the
FedEx St. Jude Classic.
Well, that's what I mean about condensing the schedule of the majors to go in four consecutive months in the spring and summer. But, yeah. So, congratulations to Scotty again. The Masters was great. Already looking forward to next year. And, yeah. What other news we got?
Well, this is actually just hot off the presses. So I want to give some shout outs here, and I've got my BGSU Honors Program shirt from 2009 on tonight. The Outthink, Outsmart, and Outlearn, as we called it,
playing on the three O's
of Survivor: Outwit, Outplay, and Outlast. But I have to give a big shout out to the BGSU baseball team. They are absolutely just killing it in MAC play this season. So college baseball is always kind of a vexing thing in the Midwest because they start the season so damn early, like in February. And like, it's, I know this February we had some nice days up in the 60s and everything, but, you know, there's other days where it's snowing. It's like 10 degrees. You can't play baseball. They play like half of the early part of the season down in Florida or Arizona or wherever. So, like, we don't even get to play any home games until, like, April, you know, when the season is already, like, half over. And so BG comes home after the non-conference part of the season in 8-11. So, you know, that's not anything that's, like, super unusual. But ladies and gentlemen, the Bowling Green Falcons have won 15 games in a row in MAC play.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the, if not the longest winning streaks in school history. Tonight, they actually had a rare non-conference series where it started, where they played Youngstown State, the Penguins of Youngstown State, shout out. That game was a 12-9 victory for the Falcons, so they have now won 16 games in a row. That is crazy. They are 8-0 at home. That's their best start at home since 1975. It's the first time in program history they've won their first 8 home games all against Division I opponents, so I guess in 1975 they must have been playing some lower division teams in there too. Yeah, just unbelievable stuff what this team's doing right now. And it's getting to the point where you wonder, like, how long could this go on? Like, could this go on to the point where BG continues to play this good? They win the MAC, they make the national championship tournament. It was about 10 years ago that Kent State, shout out Kent State, Golden Flashes, was the first MAC team to crash the College World Series. I don't know if this BG team has that kind of a pedigree, if they're really that good, or if they're just on this, like, just flat-out meteoric streak right now.
Or it could be that the MAC is terrible.
Maybe it could be that, too. I mean, I want to give our conference the benefit of the doubt.
They're like,
but
they're 4-11 outside of conference.
I mean, that's not very good. But who knows? This is quite the story, and this whole thing started for me because you actually posted in the group chat a few days ago that Akron, shout out Akron, is
no shout out to
Akron. Is at the bottom of the standings. They're 1-14 in MAC play.
Yeah, because they're garbage.
So, it's too bad they even have one win because I couldn't say how many games they've won. Zip, haha. But this is definitely something that bears watching. And I'll be completely honest with you. Even since the time I was, you know, we were in school, I watched very fervently our fall teams, particularly football, our winter teams, particularly men's and women's basketball. Never really got into spring sports. There's really not a lot of, like, you know, spectator follow-y spring sports. Like, we don't have a men's track and field program, unfortunately. So that, you know, kind of killed that off as far as I was concerned. But what, and I do have to mention this too, there was a period, I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, where the BG baseball program was actually on the chopping block. And
yep.
The university was making moves to actually eliminate that program. And some really big-time boosters were like, oh, no, you're not doing that. And they
namely,
came
Oral Hershiser.
Right. And they came forth with some big donations to renovate, upgrade Stellar Field, and do a couple of important things, you know, ensuring scholarships for future years to keep that program on proper footing. And, boy, it's paying some dividends this year. So, big shout-out to BGSU Baseball. We're definitely going to be following them for the remainder of the season to see. And when will they drop a conference game, or will they just not, you know? Who knows? Who knows how long this will go? You know, 15-0. I don't care who you play. Winning 15 games in a row in your conference is a big deal. So, you know, I'm very fascinated to see where this goes from here. So,
all right. And obviously the MAC tournament is played at Lake Erie Crushers Stadium.
Mercy Health Stadium
in
Avon.
So it does have a Northeast Ohio tie there. We'll see what happens. So,
top six teams make that tournament. So sorry, Akron, you're not going to make it.
No, they sucked. They should just eliminate their program again. Anyway, I think that's going to do it for us on this episode.
Yes, it will.
So this has been episode 280 of Living Off the Land. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you're still out there, appreciate you guys as always. You can follow us on social media.
Follow me at Stiffs McGee on X, or at Stefano.Steven on Instagram.
You can follow me at Daniel J. Ford. You can follow the show at the LOTL Podcast. And we appreciate you guys as always. So we will be back next week. The Cavaliers should be deeply entrenched in their series with the Magic. Hopefully the Guardians are staying hot. And, yeah, we will talk about all the happenings in and out of the city of Cleveland. So for that, we will bid you adieu. So for Champ, who's lying on the ground, bored out of his mind, saying, why won't these guys move? For Steven, I'm Dan. You've been listening to Living Off the Land, episode 280. And we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.